I know Alcyon have fallen in love with C2O Group as much as I have. You know, they're a private equity fund. They want to make money. They want to put money into a company, make it better and exit. But they're after falling head over heels over this. And they see the upside. They see the growth. They see the potential. And very few companies actually do what they say they're going to do. And we've probably done triple what we've always said.
It takes only one breach, one single click to take down your entire business. Imagine your life's work gone like that. Cyber criminals know this and they're targeting companies like yours every single day of the week. Nostra's Cloud Shield 365 is built to stop them. With Microsoft Business Premium, advanced threat detection and 24/7 monitoring, we protect your data, your people and your bottom line. Don't leave it to chance. Visit Nostra.ie today. That's Nostra.ie today and see how Cloud Shield 365 keeps your business safe. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code VOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20. Elevate your marketing game today.
Paul, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Gracing us with your presence all the way from Oz.
That's it.
What do you do?
I run a company called C2O Group, headquartered out of Sydney in Australia. And we work in North America and all over Australia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why'd you start that?
To do it right this time. That was probably the crux of it.
Go on. I'll ask you, how did you do it wrong the other times then?
Well, I have to go all the way back to selling Christmas trees out of the back of my van in college.
Let's go all the way back.
Look, I grew up in a family business environment in Ireland, in Cork. My father and his two brothers and sister founded a company. They're in the water, wastewater industry. Very successful business. And I suppose I would have seen the way it was set up and the stresses and the celebrations and every part of it. It was felt by everybody in the family. So from breakfast to dinner at the table, we'd be talking about it. So I saw the way my father treated people, interacted with people, built relationships, minded his people in the business, followed through on promises that he made to clients. So all of that kind of ingrained. I was definitely the entrepreneur of the family, youngest of six. So I was definitely the Scott in the background, trying to scheme a way to make a fast buck all the time.
Did you always know you wanted to do that? Did you always have that feeling?
No, I wanted to work in the family business. I had a huge desire to work there, massively. But unfortunately, that time, my father, he and his brothers, it was just the eldest got. So we have three major family blocks, and the eldest of each family block got the top job as high up as they could. So I was the youngest of six. I needed a lot of people to get out of the way.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's like the royal family here.
Yeah.
it's the Irish way, isn't it? Like, it's like the oldest brother gets the farm. It's the very Irish way of doing it.
Now, in fairness, I think my eldest brother is the right person. I think I'd be a little bit of a tsunami, I'd say, inside there. So
you've got that entrepreneurial blood and you've got the fire. So yeah. What did you do then?
I spent a long time struggling, I suppose. I wouldn't have been very studious. I struggled in school, really. And I would have tried to repeat my Leaving Cert twice, I think. The first time lasted about 6 weeks, and the second time it lasted about a week. I went to college Waterford Institute of Technology for about 3 months doing, business studies. Christmas time after the ski holiday with the college, I kind of tapped out. I held on until that was over. I went to CIT eventually, doing applied physics and instrumentation, and I spent 5 years there trying to get a 3-year qualification.
That's a hard turn right, isn't it?
It's a hard turn right. I was on a site and I saw a guy driving a Porsche on one of my father's sites, and I said, what does that guy do? And he was a PLC programmer, and I said, where can I do that college course?
You're joking me.
No, swear to God. That's so I couldn't.
So kids, if you're listening and you're filling out the CAO, just seeing who in the town is the nicest car.
But he was an independent company on his own. He was his own boss.
Right.
And he was in demand. And it was like winning the lotto, trying to get this guy on the site for this day to code all the PLCs. So I was like, what in God's name does this fella do? And I wanted to do that.
And were you technically minded, or are you just like, how hard can it be?
I didn't think it through, really. It was just, he was a cool guy, and how hard could it be? But yeah, I found out it was very hard.
Turns out, very hard. What is that? Like, is it programming? Is it engineering? What is
So I couldn't get into that college course, so I had to do applied physics instrumentation for 2 years, and then I could transfer to that college course. I can't even remember what it was called, but it was something very linked to it. But I ended up, golf was really my love at the time, and even in school or in college, like, I would have been very close to, let's say, not. So we'd go through a year and there'd be 10 subjects in CIT. I'd fail 8 or 9 of them. 50% of the marks would be on continuous assessment and 50% would go on your final exams. So I would need to get north of 80% in every exam in repeats just to pass. So, like, I would have had a very small number going into it out of the first 50. But my mother would send me down to University of Limerick to, being the youngest of 6, all my elder brothers and one sister, they were very good at school, and they've all got double degrees. So I would go down to their friends in UL. That one guy, Dr. Michael Walsh, would take me in, and all his PhD students would grind me for a 4 to 6 week period.
Boot camp,
yeah. And I'd come back and I'd get 95% in applied physics and, 1 year.
Right, so it was in there. It was in there, which you like.
Yeah. But it was really just swallowing it all and vomiting it out on a page. I didn't really understand it.
Right.
And then I was on the cusp of failing, and I had needed to put in an appeal to show them what I'd done in my final exams. And they passed me on the back of my efforts with CIT golf. So my golf helped me get through college, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So golf is the proper passion. Like how much were you playing?
Oh, like, I would play 36 holes a day, 5 days of the week, and play 18 the other two.
No way.
Yeah. And yeah.
Did you ever think about going pro?
Absolutely.
Every day.
Fully believed I was going to.
Was that the kind of, at the back of your head, or maybe the front of your head, was that the goal?
I wanted nothing else, no. But then when you're 21, 22, and there's a 14-year-old beating you by 17 shots in a round of golf above him for Isleport Rush, you're kind of like, and I was pretty happy coming off of the 78 or 79. And then you hear this young fellow McIlroy and he's shooting 61. It's like,
no way. You were there when he was.
Yeah. I shot 78 the same day on the same course and he shot 61. So he beat me by 17 shots in one round.
Like, he's probably going to be tidy, I'd say.
He got lucky that day.
If I had a sliding doors, right? That's wild. So you were at that level. You were trying to get kind of like amateur level to go pro.
I was 2 up against Shane Lowry with 3 to play in the South of Ireland in 2007. And like, yeah, just, he's such a class act. Like, I would think back to it, like, he just got it done. Like, and it was unbelievable. Like, yeah, again, there was nothing he did against me. It was just, he just hit these shots coming in. They were just, it's just different.
Level of class. And just, he seems like a sound man.
Oh, he's an absolute gent.
Yeah. He just, because like, we've a few questionable sports stars, but him and Rory, you kind of go, they just seem like a sound man. Seem like they have the crack, perform on elite level, represent the country really well.
Yeah, I would never have known Rory. He was very, very protected that time. But Shane wasn't. Shane was kind of
the Irish Open was his breakout, wasn't it? No one, I think golfers knew him before that, but outside of the mainstream, no one really knew him.
When I went to Australia in 2008, that was the Irish Open in 2009, and there was 6 amateurs playing in the event. And the year before, in the east of Ireland in Baltray, Shane was playing in front of me in the final round, and he'd blown up. I'll never forget it. He broke his 3-wood over his knee on the 18th, and I put €20 each way on every other amateur golfer. Owen Arthurs was one of them. But I didn't back Shane because I said, nah, Baltray doesn't suit him, obviously. 1,000 to 1, like.
What?
Yeah, that's the odds that they all were.
I'm trying to remember, did he miss out on a huge payout because
that was
of that?
His caddy. His caddy put 150 euros each way in him.
No, I
had 1,000 to 1. Yeah, which is
good for him.
But he didn't get it all.
No,
they downsized the odds to like 100 to 1 or something. Yeah.
Oh, after the fact.
Yeah, which they can do by all accounts. But I backed 5 of the 6, and I never backed Shane. It's like
so. Like, at what stage did you kind of decide, oh, I'm going to leave Ireland and go to Australia? Like, was that to play more golf? Was that to give up golf? What was the, where did the paths diverge?
No, I got on the Munster team, which was a huge achievement for me. Like, Seamus Power was number one on our Munster team that year of 8 people. I would have been number 8, barely getting on. And Shane was number one for Leinster. Rory was gone so high profile at that stage. He was amateur, but he wasn't playing for Ulster.
Right.
But we had, yeah, it was great fun. And I wanted to wait for that in August. My girlfriend went over in May and I waited to play golf. It was that important. When I flew to Australia, it was to play a winter of golf. That was what I was going for. And I cried the whole way to London. Like, I'd never been away from my mother for longer than a week.
Really?
No.
And why did you pick Australia?
Because Niamh was gone there. Right. So I jumped in a plane and went over. Like, when the penny dropped over there, I was kind of going, wow, are you serious? This place is real. It was at the perfect time.
2008, so kind of just before the crash, was it? Or just?
Just before.
Right.
I was there probably about 2 months when they said, yeah, don't come home.
Everything stopped. The music has stopped.
And at the same time, I was given, I might have had 20 or 30,000 Australian dollars. So I'd landed in, and then my winter of golf, I decided it was so warm in Brisbane that time. It was just so hot. But the casino poker room was quite cool and chilled. I pretty much lost all my money in 7 weeks, 8 weeks. And I went traveling the coast and stuff, and it was good fun. But I had a major problem, which was Christmas. How was I going to survive through Christmas and have a good Christmas in Sydney with $1,000 or $2,000? It was impossible.
So hold on, you just started playing poker randomly?
Yeah, well, I'd been in trouble a long time for playing poker. It wasn't a new thing.
God, this interview is going to go someplace. I'm enjoying this already. Go on.
And I needed to get a job. And I had a friend of mine from college, from CIT, that had got a job in regional New South Wales. And you'd get paid $2,500 in your hand after tax every week. So I went down to work as an instro. I was not a good instro.
What is that?
An instrumentation technician.
So don't even know what that is still.
You'd install,
say it again. I still don't know.
you'd install instrumentation on a brand new project. It was a pulp and paper mill they were building and a recovery boiler. But the recovery boiler was like 15 stories high. It was a big project. And Visy Pulp and Paper were building it. They had ABB as their major supplier and project management company. And they'd employed an O'Donnell Griffin. He was the largest electrical contractor in Australia and New Zealand at the time. So I went to the site, and my plan was to work there for 7 weeks before Christmas and then have enough money. I'd have surely 10 or 12 grand saved up by then. My rent was like $100 a week in a motel, sharing a room with my buddy. And Niamh stayed in Brisbane to stay saving money as well during that 7 week period. And about 2 weeks before I left the job for Christmas, they were looking for a supervisor to run the recovery boiler. And I just kind of went, God, I wouldn't mind that. And I came back after Christmas, luckily, to that job. And it was from there, everything kind of started. Momentum just went from there very quickly.
And what about coming home? You just kind of parked that for a while crash? Or why didn't you come home to play golf?
No, it was just work had turned into my passion. Literally, I had a team of 30, 40 guys in the recovery boiler, lots of them Irish, and it was, the fun was off the charts. I obviously was making a lot of money at the time. I was making a lot more than $2,500 a week after tax now at this stage.
Thinking they got you back with a big offer. It's like he didn't just come back for the crack there. Like.
And no, it was unreal. And I learned about, it was just great fun. And because I'd worked on the ground, I understood what it was to have a supervisor. So I would never ask anybody to do anything that I wouldn't be willing to do myself. So it was a good band. So we'd went there. That was good fun. But like the friendships that we made down there was just unbelievable. It was best time I've ever had, really.
So how long did you do that for?
I was there for the bones of a year, really. And then went up to Sydney when O'Donnell Griffin got sponsored. You have to kind of get sponsorship if you want to stay. So I got sponsored and went up to Sydney working on the rail alliance in Sydney with Lang O'Rourke, O'Donnell Griffin and Oricon. And now I was in the rail industry in New South Wales, which it was the first private business that went in, allowed to do work on the Sydney Trains Network. So I went in there and scheduling there was like minute by minute during a possession. And you needed to know your people by the minute, your equipment, materials by the minute. So you'd be planning for 3 months up to a 72-hour shutdown of the rail network.
And what were you doing?
So I was the engineer underneath, the electrical engineer, trying to help coordinate the workforce, the subcontractors, making sure that all the materials were in place, making sure that all of the assets we were touching were allowed to be touched. You've got Sydney Trains had never left anybody from outside of Sydney Trains go in there and have this much ownership. So you had a big trust issue between Sydney Trains and the JV. But yeah, that was great fun. And then I find out that my girlfriend at the time was pregnant with her first child. And then the juices really started going, I suppose. It was my just cause or my kind of driver was like, whoa, I need to stop blowing money here.
Did that change how you operated?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was bananas. So then I was like, because I would have been blowing every dollar that came into my bank account. At the time, the crack was 90 in Sydney. And yeah, it was unbelievable. And
the glint in your eyes, you say that. If you're not watching this interview, go over to YouTube and watch it. This is a good one.
I needed to get a proper job because Niamh wasn't able to stay working. It was going to be expensive to raise a child in Sydney, especially. So I rang home about getting a job back in the family business. And we fell out over a Ford Focus and a Toyota Corolla van. That was literally what we fell out over. And the money was like 46 or 50 grand a year, maybe. It wouldn't have been north of 50. And then one day I was kind of half crying in the back. And my boss at the time said, ring this guy. He's looking for someone to work on the Vic Diesel down in Melbourne. So I rang the guy and I was down on site a week later doing an interview. And this was the second largest desalination plant on the planet outside of Dubai, being built in Melbourne, but a 2-hour drive south of Melbourne in Phillip Island. And where the penguins are, that is a big issue at the time because we didn't want the penguins to get sucked into the pipe, bringing the salt water. but I was down on site there, and this site was, I mean, it was a $3.5 billion lump sum contract. Degremont, a French company, and an Australian company called Thiess were the joint venture. And when they signed the contract, Melbourne was going to run out of water. It was a proper drought. But the day they signed the contract, it just started raining and never stopped raining. So all the dams were full. And this company, the joint venture, were looking at a significant loss when I got down there.
What, they were going to pull the project or what?
No, like they were going to lose. They could have lost $5 billion there. It was just a huge problem at the time.
Why?
The job was going nowhere.
Okay, they just couldn't get it going.
No, they couldn't get the workforce going. It was a very challenging location. The weather was very bad.
Right.
The land was not as it was meant to be. Let's say that the workforce were not motivated to work. So I was there probably for about 6 months with some great people.
So you got the job, moved down.
We got free accommodation, 160 grand a year and a free car. So the free accommodation and the money.
Happy days.
Was happy days. And I went down there. And I would have worked 20 hours a day learning my job. It was the main intake substation and the main plant substation was my area. I convinced the project director to let me subcontract it out. And I subbed it out to O'Donnell Griffin. Now, I didn't know any of those guys in Victoria, but I knew I could manage a contract from being around it in the family business. I couldn't manage it any other way. I wouldn't have been able to manage it myself.
So your way of getting the project going was to go back to what you knew, which is subbing it out.
Which was this tiny little area in the corner of the plant. Like there was probably 5,000 people on the project. I had 50 people in my little corner, but it was the most important corner. And when the real boys came in to fix the job, and this guy, John Barraclough, who would be an absolute legend of the Australian, the the construction industry in Australia, like this guy is, he's held CEO of big companies doing multi-billion dollar revenue. He was the project director of the Sydney Olympics. And just honestly, just an absolute hero of a man. He came in and he would have really cleared out two levels of management. And he picked me out of a very low down group and just said, you're one of my six or seven guys that's going to get this job built. And I never got an email back from him with anything more than yes, no, call me. That was all I ever got from him in an email.
I love that.
Just, yeah.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. He used to smoke cigarettes around the job. And I remember when the Degremont guys in our Saturday morning meeting wanted to make it a smoke-free zone, he just started laughing. He was like, no. But real old school and real integrity driven. Like it was a project that needed that moral compass true north. So
you've had an incredible amount of experiences there in a very short space of time. Like did you shape how you operate as a founder?
Yeah. I think the fear of not being able to provide for Sean and Niamh was probably the reason that I worked so hard. So I went working 20 hour days. It was bananas.
How did you manage that then when Sean arrived?
I was probably really good at the time because the job was probably about 4 kilometers from where we lived. So it's very good then. But when we started our first journey of setting up EPS Group Australia, and I called it the same name as our family business in Ireland, under the premise of, oh, well, I'm the youngest of six and they put me on the opposite side of the world to get the family business going over there. Like it would have been to get going. You can't be a brand new startup.
I was either going to either do that, put two fingers up to the family business or no. To kind of make it look bigger.
No, to make it look bigger. I asked my father, could I, before I did, and he told me to drive on, so I did.
So bring me back though, with this project here, how long were you down there?
I was down there for 2.5 years. Yeah, it's a significant project. It's quite amazing. Yeah.
And what came next?
Setting up the business with a guy. I was the, at the end of that project, I was the completions director for construction and handing over to commissioning. So I was like the interpreter between construction and commissioning. And it was the first real time that the concept was used in the Australian industry anyway. So the guy I was handing over to in commissioning, John Cox.
What's commissioning?
Commissioning is when you start everything up and you start turning it on.
Right.
It's energized. It's
It's built, but not live.
Not live. Okay. Yeah. So when you start turning it on, you need permit to work. It's very controlled. We 220 kV coming into a site, which is pretty significant. And then 33 kV around the project, energizing different switch yards and switch rooms. So it's very, very important that it's done by a qualified group of people that have done it before. So the guy that I handed the stuff over to in commissioning, me and him set up EPS Group Australia. So our goal was to turn over $5 million in our first year. We turned over 40. I remember going to our first board meeting, our first meeting with our accountants, and I was like, what's that EBITDA? What does that mean? And they were telling me, and I was like, okay, but like, where is that money? And like, seriously.
Is that mine? Can I have it right
where
now?
Where is it? And then I started to understand about depreciation and literally learned it from like that. Yeah, it
was. That's wild.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did the spark come from to set up your own thing though?
Do you know, I was offered a very big job by Thies at the end of the DSAL, but I needed to go to Perth and I needed to do mechanical, something that it wasn't my, I was like, I've just worked for the last 2.5 years for you doing electrical construction and instrumentation, high voltage. Why in God's name are you putting me into mechanical? When they had one of the biggest electrical jobs in Australia at the time with QGC Upstream on the British Gas contract. But because of politics within Thies, I had to go to Perth and be minded in Perth doing a mechanical bid for Impex. And then I just kind of went, you know, I just want to tick this box now because there's another kid going to come. I would have had a fair amount of money now stashed away. So I had a couple of million dollars to invest in a new startup. And I just wanted to tick the box and John Barclough said, drive on, you're don't die wondering. So.
Okay. And what was the idea? What did you set up?
So when I was client side with Thies, I would ask a subcontractor for 5 electricians and 2 instros and I want them on Monday and I want them for 3 months. I'd come in on Monday and they'd have 1 electrician and no instro and kind of say, you don't need them really. And it was so frustrating because I'd have to keep explaining myself to them all the time. and I'd have met, say, 10 different subcontractors at any given time. I couldn't explain. I had 360 degree vision of my problems. They didn't know my problems. I just needed them to give me what I wanted and to do it in my way. And I'll explain it to them later. But no one would give it to me. There was no one in the Australian market that I could actually go, can I get 3 pears and 2 bananas on a Monday, please? They would come back in on a Monday with two bananas and 3 oranges. And I'd be like, mate, I just wanted what I asked for. So that was the core of what we were setting up the company for, was to just give the client what they wanted, tell them the truth, and hire good people and pay them well. And 3 years later, we're sitting in a room signing paperwork in London, having it sold to a Scottish company that for a significant amount of money. It was an amazing journey. But yeah, I went on then probably the worst year and a half, 2 years of my life, watching. And there was nothing wrong with the way they did it, don't get me wrong, but the guy that founded Enermec, like Doug Duquette, is one of the smartest and best guys you'll ever meet in your life. Like, he's an absolute one in a generation type guy. But the business was just different to the way it wasn't, like, it wasn't in touch with the people as much as we were.
So hold on, you started it, did 40 million the first year, sold it in the third year.
No, did 82 million. We started in December of 2012. The financial year goes the 1st of July to the 30th of June.
Right.
So I think we did 5 or 6 million for the first 6 months. Nice. Then we did 42 million. Then we did 84 million. And then we were on the way to doing 100 million. But we sold in December 2016 or 17. It was very quick.
Why'd you sell?
I thought we'd reached our ceiling. And along with, we were approached. We didn't go out to sell it. We were approached. So the idea was put in our heads. There was big tax incentives at the time as well. So you got a lot of the money off the table. Mm. And so, yeah, probably money, but also I deep down, I didn't really believe that we could go much further. And to be honest, when I look back on it, it was probably the right call.
Mm.
It wasn't, the team wasn't there to go on the way it was.
So did you stay with the company then, or did you move?
I stayed with the company. I had to move to Houston and be... Yeah, I was pretty much in charge of our stuff in America. And then I took charge of another section of the business over there. And yeah, very different culture, very different environment. So like, just very different to the way we would have operated.
What did it feel like, though, going from owner to employee?
With Doug, it was easy, but you couldn't get Doug all the time. So it was very hard with everybody else. They didn't get it. There wasn't many other dogs in the business.
Someone described it to me recently. They were talking about their earnout, and they were kind of saying, "Oh, look, I hate it. I've all the responsibility and none of the power to solve the problem." People are still coming to them going, "Oh, Paul, I need this, I need that." And you're like, "Well, I'll have to put that up the chain." Whereas you're used to making decisions quickly. Was it like that, or was it just different for you?
It was just, The business, the Enermec business, had grown so big and so fast, and it was an absolute cracking business. Like, I mean, everything they did in different services in the same industries. So we would have been real electrical instrumentation, high voltage. They were industrial services. They were pipelines underground. They were cranes offshore. They did training facilities where they'd upskill drivers on cranes offshore. Like, they were on the back of the North Sea, really, the offshore expansion. That's where they all came from. But it was a different environment. It was a different culture, I suppose. Maybe it was because of so many wounds over the years of being taken advantage of by people. But it was different, but it was still a cracking business. I think now I'm looking back only from our discussion earlier about some of the things I've realized in the last few weeks. Yeah, I think it's just learning from people's, learning from experiences. I won't say mistakes.
And what? Yeah, they're all experiences. They're only mistakes if you repeat them again and again, right? Yeah. They're experiences if you learn from them.
Yeah.
At what point then did you go, nah, I don't want to do this anymore?
Oh yeah. Like, I was 7-8 months in. I would have been emailing Doug 6 months before the final end of the exit, saying, mate, just leave me go now. Like, the enjoyment was totally gone out of it. Didn't enjoy one bit of it. And it wasn't because of any individual person. It was just overall, the machine was just different to what I thought it was going to be.
And you'd moved to the States as well.
I was in and out of Houston. Like, I'd fly from Houston to Sydney. Yeah.
Not an easy commute.
It's not, like, but sure, I was celebrating as well. Like, someone had put a ball of money into my bank account. So going to Houston, like, coming back to Sydney was probably the detox of the celebrations as well. It was a crazy period in my life. And again, you're a number of things were at play. A lump of like proper money put into your account. You're celebrating. You're in an environment that you feel that someone's burning your company down. And yeah, it's all just playing at, yeah, really brought me to my lowest point in my life by far.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, by far. Yeah. Hugely. Yeah.
In what way?
Just personally, I was broken. I was absolutely broken. Come the end of the earnout, I was totally broken, barely able to stand up. Probably took me, I'm going to say 12 months, but it probably took me 24 months to get my feet back underneath me properly. Yeah. And confidence has only come back in the last 12 months, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Big time.
What drove that? Like, what brought you there?
A number of factors. I think too much alcohol was definitely one of them. But just stress and not enough good people around me that had done it before, you know?
I know what you mean.
Probably, yeah.
And you've had a life-changing event. Like, when you do think about it, like, you've built this thing pretty quickly, and then someone hands you a life-changing amount of money.
Yeah.
We had this chat over coffee. Like, you know, Irish people aren't used to having money.
No. It was very well put by you, actually. I didn't actually realize my father's generation probably was the first generation in Ireland to have proper cash.
I think so. Like, when you think about, like, Ireland and its history, like, it's young, like.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an old country, but it's young in terms of, like, development.
Yeah.
In terms of money, proper money. Like,
yeah.
You know, this whole thing about new money. Most of Ireland is new money.
Yeah. It's unbelievable, though. Even from where I'm from in Cork, I know Killian mentioned me and Kieran Walsh, but like Kieran Murphy from Lawyer near NAD, like he was the CEO of GE Healthcare. He went to the same school as me. There's maybe 50 people that live in Lawyer, and this guy is CEO of a division of a Thomas Edison company. You know, it's unbelievable. So there's other huge players in the Irish people abroad are doing really well. I forget his name now, but the CEO of Qantas as well, like,
oh yeah,
Alan Joyce.
Yes.
Like an amazing human being. If you saw some of the things that he did over in Australia, it's off the chain.
Why do you think Irish people punch way above their weight when it comes to being abroad?
Overseas, Irish, help Irish. Believe it or not.
Is it the network?
Unbelievable. Irish abroad are unbelievably supportive of each other, understanding of each other. And then you come back here to Ireland and it's like, what is going on? It's amazing. It's I'm not saying it's everybody, but it's definitely a very different culture than what I'm used to.
What, when you, I was thinking about this driving in today, actually, I was really keen to get your insights in it. When you look back in Ireland now, because we're too close to be able to make an analysis of it, where do you think Ireland is now, kind of like economically, even from a perception basis abroad?
I think the abroad Irish workers coming in, the craft are all painted with the same brush of they won't be in on Monday, right? That's just you're painted with that brush, which... It's probably a very valid thing over the years in Australia that the work did go on the piss so hard on a Saturday and Sunday, they wouldn't turn up to work every Monday.
Even still, is that still
they'd be painted with that brush, yeah. Wow. It's getting rid of it. But abroad, companies love the Irish engineer, supervisor, project manager, because their just work ethic is just, like even a guy that goes to Australia, I think it's the weather and everything else, just people are not vicious or malice in any way. A lot of good Irish over there, and the best tends to get sucked out of them. And compared to the local Australian engineer that has grown up surfing every morning, and it's about life for them. Yeah. It's not about work. I'm in awe. I'm actually envious of the Australian friends I have. And at 5 o'clock on a Friday, even if the bombs are going off around them, they can just walk out the door without a care in the world. And they come back in Monday morning at 8 o'clock and it's like, right. And it hasn't affected them all weekend. Like if I left something, I'd be envious of it.
But Irish guilt, like.
They're dead right.
Yeah.
They're dead right.
I think it's trying to find the balance between the two, right? I think Irish people, we're getting a bit better. I think we're a bit more aware. I think me and you were chatting, you know, the older generation might have just, didn't put oil in the engine, like just kept burning and burning. Whereas I think the younger generation are finding a bit more balance, but it's trying to find that sweet spot between keeping the work ethic high and driving on,
but
still being able to have the crack and enjoy yourself and be with your family and things like that.
Absolutely.
So you think it's a combination of those factors. And then when you come home, because you travel home a bit, what are you seeing happening? Like, what are you seeing happening in Ireland? What's your kind of impression?
Dublin's very like Sydney. It's unbelievable. I have two friends that work for me, or two finance people. One that left to move home about 6 months ago, Sean Flanagan, and Sarah Grace is back on a holiday. So I met them last night up here, and it's like being in Sydney. It's probably better than Sydney, the buzz at the moment. Cork is kind of like that. Not as much, really. Not as high level, but outside of that, Ireland's just... I spend all my time in Lahinch when I'm here as much as I can, and it's an amazing part. Ireland's got a huge potential if it just did a few things better, you know.
What are those things? Let's solve it right now. Let's get you elected.
No.
Everyone's running for president. You may as well have a crack.
My past will be dragged off. They'll dig too deep.
Would you do? If you're like, right, if we could just implement, because you've been all over the world, right? You've seen best practice in the US and Oz and here, everywhere. Like, what would you do? Like, because you've seen the best business practices, what would you do even from a business point of view to make Ireland more competitive?
When we sold our company in Australia, the Australian ATO, the tax office, had a rollover relief, they call it. So capital gains tax was at 45%. So if you held the shares for longer than a year, you got a 50% reduction in that. But then they had an extra rollover, was that if you bought a business within a year before your exit, or after your exit within 6 months, it actually came off another 50% relief after capital gains. So
if you bought another business.
Yeah. So what it did was it kept the smart business people in the business.
That's clever.
In the game. Which is unbelievable. So it might have been one of my business partners, they both bought farms, and one of them bought a couple of laundromats. And do you know, but they now all of a sudden they're inside in new business lines that they wouldn't have been in, and they were still involved, which then makes them stay in the game for when they're ready to kick back on again.
That's huge.
Yeah, huge.
We have an issue with that here in Ireland, like going ahead.
I think the pensions, they call it superannuation in Australia, but you shouldn't have a cap on your pension, because that's once the smart people hit their pension ceiling, so what are they working for? You know, it's another one. I don't know if this is happening here or not, but there's some really key guys in the Australian construction infrastructure businesses that would join the government as senior advisors and kind of take control of it. I don't know if that happens here, but it's very public knowledge in Australia. So like Nev Power would be one of them. He was very high up in Leighton and Tees. He's with FMG Salomon, with Twiggy Forrest, and he has been a senior advisor straight after COVID. He was in making sure the businesses were taken care of. They're very proactive like that, hugely. Mm. Yeah. So it's like, it's a country that's, it's a unique place, Australia. It's amazing. I'm sure America was like it back in the day.
Is that home now?
When I land in Sydney, it feels like I'm landing home, yeah. But it's not home. Like my bed is still at home. My parents' house, it's my room. My nephew, bloody, was inside my bed the last time I went home. I was like, what is going on, man? Get out. So yeah, it's, no home. It's amazing. I love it here. I love it here, but I wouldn't like to, I don't know how, I don't think I'd ever have been able to start a business here, ever. I don't think I would have got through that threshold. So I've awesome, I'm in awe at the likes of Kieran Walsh with National Beauty and stuff. I'm in awe at anybody that's got a business going here, because it's not an easy place. It's far from it. Very hard.
You made a lovely point over coffee earlier about your environment. Your environment matters. Like, you think shifting your environment shifted something in you.
Yeah, and situation as well. Like when we started, when we'd gone through the journey, and I was like, it was in the middle of COVID, probably 3 or 6 months into COVID. Let's just say I wouldn't have been very aligned to the restrictions of not driving 3 kilometers. I would have, the odd time, got the ferry from Belfast to Scotland and drove down to Heathrow and flown to play a golf tournament somewhere. So I would have been known in Australia. And there was a man in Australia called John Schaefer that he married a girl from Cork, and he sold his business in the year 2000, and they moved back to Ireland, to Cork, to relocate for their kids, for their upbringing. Now, they lived there for 5 or 6 years, but they lived alongside Niamh, my girlfriend and then wife, in Cork. And when we went to Sydney and with the EPS Group Australia company, we bumped into them, and I became best of friends with John. Now, John went to school with Phil Green, the founder of Alcyon. So when you meet them for dinner, the two boys are just fighting about silly stuff, like, you're not the smartest person in the room, and like, they'd be literally having it on. So during COVID, they'd invested in a company in Europe. They couldn't travel over the restrictions, but they knew I was doing a little bit of travel. So I went doing due diligence for them on this company in Israel, it was actually. But I was able to travel to Europe easily to meet them, meet the team. So I spent probably a year doing that. Christmas Day.
This was after your exit, was it?
Yeah,
this where, is. 20, where are we in the timeline now? So 2020. Just refresh me on the timeline. So you'd exited the business in what year?
2018. The 9th of June, 2018.
9th of June. Burned in
I know
memory.
The days, yeah. Yeah.
Was that the day you finished the earn-out, or was that the day you got the
That was the day I jumped on a plane and flew out of Houston.
Okay. So that was your last day?
Yeah, it was my last day.
So then, you said you kind of the next 6 months to 12 months, even 24 months were challenging.
Yeah.
And then it was when the lads kind of contacted you in 2020, you were like, right, this
would be March or April time, maybe June time. Would I do some work? All I was doing was playing golf. I was living the dream. We'd been to Australia in December and January 19 and 20, and we were probably going to move back.
Okay. So you were kind of hopping between the two places then, were you?
No, we'd literally at the end of 2019, we went on a 6 week trip to Australia, and we were going to move back probably in June or July once they finished school, the kids.
Okay.
And we were going back to Australia. Definitely by September, we were going to be back there in 2020. COVID obviously kicked in shortly afterwards. And then in probably May or June, I got contacted by John in Sydney. Would I help them with this investment in Israel? So I started back into it on Teams calls, and like Christmas Day 2020, I spent 8 hours on a Teams call to Phil Green.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And he fell asleep for a good hour of it. And I was coming in and back and in and out, kind of going, hello, hello.
What, just trying to do the deal or what? No, what was the urgency?
It was just trying to get, it was a great business. You had an inventor founder that wouldn't spend money on anything but inventing. So you'd give him $10 million and he'd be after spending $10 million inventing the next 10 apples for his basket, but he wouldn't start selling the 15 apples that he already had in his basket. So
if you apply marketing and sales and business ops to that.
He had no salesman. So it was trying to, and he had his distribution being done by his main competitors. So when they got the distribution rights, they just threw it into the drawer and he just didn't get it. So it didn't work out. I tried very hard, and I really thought I was going to get it over the line. I'd offered to invest money in it now at this stage. I was going to be the CEO and I was gone. So, yeah, it was an unbelievable business. So when it didn't work out, and I could have asked for whatever I needed to ask for in fees, and it could have been a 6 zeros at the end of it for sure. I just said, I wanted you to have a look at this IM, Phil. And he just said, done.
Have a look at what?
Like I built an IM at this stage about this new C2O 2.0.
What's an IM?
An information memorandum.
Okay,
sorry.
I'm like, what?
I'm a genius.
What
I don't know. I've done it twice enough.
You have so many acronyms.
I've done it twice. I was trying to think of what an IM fucking stuff is.
An old memo. Yeah. So you built up. So while you were kind of noodling on this investment deal, you were kind of thinking about the next thing, were you?
Yeah, something sparked probably about 3 or 4 months before.
Right.
And myself.
Did that get the juices going looking at this deal? Did that get the juices going again for
definitely.
A new thing?
And it was the feel like I was so scared that if I went back into the industry. It had been said to me a few times. I'd heard the comment, anybody can do it once. Oof. Now, I probably could have made it up in my head as well. If someone
I wouldn't
said
mind
it.
Just doing it the once again, getting your payout.
So I...
Did that bug you?
Oh, yeah.
Did it?
Oh, proper, yeah.
Really?
And my daughter, I remember in May saying to me, oh, Dad, does all you do play golf? Do you not work? I remember kind of going, I'm a wicked hard worker. So, because it was back to then before...
What age was she?
She would have been 5.
Okay, wow. So she's very young, yeah.
And back in my, before I went to Australia.
2 years, she would have been three, yeah.
I was known as the guy that never worked. You know, the messer. So then I was like, went to Australia and I worked.
All that past trauma is coming back to the fore again.
I didn't work, so yeah. I went pretty hard, yeah. So I went back and look, I'd done my research on Phil. I dealt with him and it all worked out really. I flew to Australia the week before the restrictions, or the week after. It was 2 days after the restrictions were lifted where you didn't need to do 2 weeks of quarantine. So literally I was taught I was doing 2 weeks of quarantine in Sydney, but then they lifted it. So I got in and got out and I spent probably 2 months there getting the deal done.
What was the deal? Like, what were you doing here? You came up with a new idea for a new company.
Yeah, so we'd a company lined up in Melbourne to buy.
Okay, you were going to buy a company.
And we had a company in Houston that we were going to buy. Oh. And both companies were severely impacted by COVID, but they were great companies. The one in Australia, in Melbourne, I dealt with on Vic Diesel. They were a subcontractor, real specialist high voltage testing and like high voltage company, really. So I'd known them. The company in the US, I had actually tried to buy his previous business in our EPS Group Australia journey. I went to the US that time, but I hadn't figured out the game over there. So then we bought both businesses. Now I wanted to buy them both on the same day. Phil convinced me. I was like throwing all my ties out of the pram. I was like, no, if we're not buying both, we're not doing the deal.
Why did you want to buy them on the same day?
It was all linked. I find it hard to get what's in my head out the right way, but it was C2O Group needed to have the link between Australia and the US. It was critical to the whole plan.
Right. Explain to me in very layman's terms what your new idea was.
To build the exact same business that we had in EPS. However, get the right partners in place and the right management team around me.
Right.
And employ people the right way and do it better and get full trust throughout the business.
And why did you want to buy the two companies then straight away?
Because I needed a start. I didn't want to start from zero.
You didn't want zero, right.
And we got the businesses very, very cheap in the scheme of things. COVID had impacted them. At the time, you remember the world was ending.
I feel like, look, I think we forget. Like, I think we've all had a bit of post-traumatic stress after COVID. We all just kind of walked away and went, that's grand now. No scars, no trauma, just walk away, continue the world as normal. Sure, like, we've just buried a lot of that kind of stuff at the back of our minds. Like, it was mad times. This is the end of the world, sure.
Yeah, we had put, from my previous business, I'd learned these things called a call and a put option. So we'd actually put a call and put option in place with both companies in mid-21. So it wasn't even, we were trying to buy them in March. The deal was done. All we needed to do was get the Alcyon funding in. So it was, we had certainty. And by the time we were buying the businesses, the world was starting to change. Back to normality.
Okay, so the prices were going, it was rebounding.
What had happened in Australia, especially in Victoria, was everything stopped. Like, it went to a proper standstill. So every project stopped. The government were loading in new projects, trying to make sure that they re-energized the country after COVID. So that would all have been in my head when I was kind of, hang on a minute.
So you could see the picture kind of falling into place here. You're like, we went to zero, now we're going to try to go back to 100. In the space, a really short space of time, I need to be positioned there to take advantage of it.
And my main competitors were the company that I'd sold and two split half companies that had set up my past employees that had set up. And yeah, there was a good just cause. Let's go back and play the game. I was very nervous though. Very nervous. I totally underestimated how hard it was to get a deal over the line with a private equity fund. First time I physically dealt with a private equity fund, and it was very tricky, like total underestimated.
So you had to learn all that.
Yeah.
What were the key things you wish you'd known before?
Not to buy two companies in two different regions at the same time.
Like, on the same day.
Yeah. Even 3 months apart nearly gave me a nervous breakdown. I think just knowing that when you go to a law firm about M&A, to act for you on a deal like that, you have to get someone that does it 5 days of the week, you know, all the time. Not a guy that does wills on a Monday, Tuesday and does. But seriously though, it's a mistake I made trying to get a cheaper deal.
Right.
I dealt with Jeremy Liebler from Arnold Black Liebler on the sale process of our previous company, but his price was 200K and this guy's price was 30K. And we were a startup. You know, you don't want to waste money and how hard can it be? And yeah, there you go. It ended up costing 300K.
By cheap, by and Jeremy, 10 times.
And Jeremy was the one that did it in the end.
Big smug look on his face, and you come back in the door.
Yeah, no, they're great. They're all one group. And they're all great friends. So
you bought these two businesses, set up the C2O group, and you're back in the game.
And yeah, but we'd set up a structure with myself and Alcyon were the two money inputters. And then we had another group of like 6-8 people behind us. We'd 6 people at Topco that had shares, quasi like shares gifted to them really in the scheme of things. And then the shares in the US business, there were minor shareholders within the business that we bought. So we didn't buy 100% of it. We bought 88% of it, let's say.
Okay. Did you have to raise much cash for these purchases then?
No, we did it all for about, there was a couple of working cap facilities and stuff like that, but hard cash raised probably $14 million.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, so I would have been a major chunk of, there was 3 of us. And yeah, I would have been a major chunk of it. And Alcyon would have been a bigger chunk. And through the first year and a half, really, it was about building trust between both sides. And I just made an absolute commitment to myself. I was never going to lie to them. I was going to tell them the truth all the time. I'd been warned about private equity. You know, they'll always, there'll be bad stories. But I just said, you know what? I'm going to go into this now. Moral compass true north. Tell them the truth. And if they want to be bad, they can be bad. And that's the way I went in. And it was the best thing I've ever done.
Well, you're being yourself, right? You were taking all the lessons you'd learned from the past and you're just being yourself.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be, yeah, like I remember going to Phil probably 5 months in and we'd got our first big win and it was 150 people into our project. Like there was 20 employees in both companies when we started it. And then we brought in 68 people on top. So there was 28. Company went from losing 50 grand a month to losing a lot more. But we had it all planned out. We knew it was going to take a year to get going. And I remember going to Phil in Sydney. I look back now, he must have thought it was crazy. I didn't realize who I was dealing with really at the time either. But I was like, I don't know. I need something like 5 million or 10 million. I don't know. But can I have it? Yes or no? And like, it was just, but, and I would have just stormed into the PE office. Like, where's Phil? So it was just, yeah. I've come a long way. He's an absolute hero of a man.
There's a beauty in naivety too, though. There's a beauty in being totally fresh, total different approach to things.
Yeah. I think he definitely saw something, even through the DD, and it was probably the investment in Israel back in the day. He just saw something and he half, I'd say, is living his giggles through me as well. So yeah. Yeah, he's a special man.
So what was the first couple of years like? Then you're back in, what year is this now? This is 21, 22?
We're in 22. We're in 23 now. We're at the end of 22.
Okay, so it was losing a good bit of cash, small enough team. You brought it up to 28. It was losing a bit of cash. What did you do?
So today it was just about winning work. And it was about getting a chance off a client. And that's what it is. It's just trust. Give us a go to be better than that company over there that you're giving 100% of the work to. Mm. So you get a bit and you just keep delivering and you get good people.
So you're back doing the same thing you were doing before.
Yeah.
Same role.
Yeah.
But you've got a company now in the US doing it and you've a company in Australia doing it.
Yeah. And the US, I'd learned, my contacts in the US at that point in time were way stronger than they were in Australia because I'd spent 2 years in the US. So I'd been out of the Australian game for 5 years, really. So it was like our non-compete finished in February and we bought the first company in March. 22. Like it was literally the following day. I think 12 days into March we bought it. So I was a bit disappointed that I'd lost that 12 days. I was chaffing it a bit.
What was your feeling when you walked back in the door? I suppose you didn't walk back in the door. But when you signed the deal, right, you're like, yes, the first one's over the line. What did you feel?
Pure excitement. You know, I'm top of the world. I'm sorted for life. Oh, what else could I need? And then slowly realized it's paper. And it's worth nothing. And there was no one to hang around with because there was no one else but money at my age. And it was boring.
Right. And you're just waiting to get back into the game.
Yeah. Yeah. But I needed time to kind of get my brain back right as well because I'd been through a traumatic experience, let's say, throughout the whole lot of it, the good and the bad. It was proper learning curve.
And where was your brain then when you bought these two companies? Like, what were you feeling? Like, were you like, yes, I'm going to do this because of this? Or where was your brain?
Anxiety through the roof.
Really?
Like, oh, man, stop. Unbelievable. I was so scared. I was having nightmares that it wouldn't work. That it, like, just the fear of failure was just so strong. It was unbelievable.
I think that's really interesting, though, because people listening, I think, would be very surprised to hear that. And thanks for sharing, because I think a lot of people would look at you and go, sure, he did it once. Like, he's been through it all. Like, I think there's this myth that, oh, once you do it, you don't get anxious, you don't have imposter syndrome, or you don't get, like, nervous anymore. Whereas, like, all the great people I meet, like you, they still have it with them. They just get better at managing it.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's one of those movies, you know, where someone gets picked to go on the Premiership soccer team and they're like, woohoo, losers, we'll see you later. But then you come back a week later with a broken fucking knee and you're, whoa.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of fallen off my little rosy perch, I think. Perch I did in my head anyway.
So were you proving it to yourself that you could do it again, or were you proving it to others, or both?
You know, I was just, I needed it for myself, I'd say, more than anything. It was, yeah, for myself, really. I knew that couldn't be the last goal. I was in Ireland. I tried a lot now in Ireland. Like, I mean, I tried to set up an F45 gym. Yeah. Not a good investment for me anyway. I'm sure other people have had better experiences, but it's still going. It's going good now, but like,
when did you do that?
In like at the very start. Like I was opening it in 2019. I'd invested in other health clubs. I was a buzzing investor. But like I'd no interest. Like I couldn't keep my attention span for longer than 10 minutes. And anything that I did get involved in, I just got too involved in. So it's just literally, I was nearly training in the F45 at one point. Like, I think I've been to 4 classes there in its entirety. Like, I go in to go for a shower and steal the hoodies because they're really nice hoodies.
So what were the lessons then you learned from that experience? Is it like stick to the knitting, go back to what you know? Or what were your lessons from investing in other projects?
I just never invest in something that I don't have control of or a hand in. I won't invest in anything that I don't understand or couldn't get my head around. I see so many opportunities with helping people with businesses that, yeah, I'd love my father to get a USB stick into his head now 30 years, 40 years ago, and my uncles, because it's, as you said, it's new to this economy in a lot of ways, but in Australia, it's not new. They're on fifth generation now. And they've learned how to do it wrong and they've learned how to do it right. And they probably don't understand what the 15th generation is going to need, but they definitely know how to get to number 5 the easiest way now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that have done it the wrong way and a few who have done it the right way.
So if people are listening to this, and we have a lot of founders who've maybe sold a business recently or, you know, are on the verge maybe of selling their businesses, what would your key things to be to remember? The key things you wish you'd known the first time around when you sold?
I think you're told a lot of advice, but you don't listen. You think you know, but you don't know. That makes sense. It kind of goes in one ear and out the other. When the pupil is ready, the teacher will come. I heard that one recently. I'm like, okay, that makes sense now. The experience, you must surround yourself with the right partner at any given time. And there's the right partner for everybody's different part of their journey. So if you were a family business handing down to the next generation, I would get a private equity fund involved that didn't want to take a majority, that wanted dividends to be spat out to them. It was a pure cash play, but they brought experience and advice on how to build your business into. Like, I'd give them a very cheap multiple on the way in. And if anything above that multiple or anything above that EBITDA from when they come in to when they exit, they might get 3 times more of a multiple on the way out. But there are PE funds like that, I've learned, that are long 4th and 5th generation families' money. They're ultra, ultra high net worth that literally have PE funds set up and they leverage the experience of their family to get into businesses like that. And they don't want to do anything, only do right by them. They want to give them the advice. They want to make money along the way, and they want to share in the upside while you're on the learning curve. It's better to have 50% of something than 100% of nothing. I think the other thing is I would never give my kids a business ever. they can do whatever they want. They can grow it themselves or build it themselves. And if they want to get involved in it, they can beg for it. But like, they'll have to do a number of things to get into our industry, and they must be aligned to the values of what we're doing. I felt like I was a loser because I didn't get into our family business. You should never put that onus on a child, I don't think.
So what age are your kids now?
14, 11 and 9.
Okay. So in 4 years time, 5 years time, if to go to college or not, depends. You might be having that conversation. How does that go?
They were in Australia now for 3 weeks. They came back 2 weeks ago. So we 3 weeks there. Alcyon, the P Fund, they own Lego in Australia. So my kids got to spend a day working in Lego.
I definitely prefer to go work there, no offense.
I had them working in our business. We put up a video on LinkedIn recently of all of the founders' kids, shouting out the values of the company. And they were having meetings, and we'd fake people lined up for them to ring and try and recruit people. And it was awesome. They got their own t-shirts, and we gave them a letter afterwards that they were employed once they were 16 years of age.
That's cool.
My 15-year-old was raising purchase orders and having fun. And then they went working in Combank for a day on the trading floor. Alcyon took them in around their place for a few hours. Alcyon do a great thing with kids where they give them $1,000. They show them how to invest. They show them how to trade. And then they come back on the Friday and they give them their advisors for the week. And then they come back on a Friday and they're told where they went right, where they went wrong. And
I love that.
It's brilliant because it's exposing them to everything. And if I had my time back, if I was to do the perfect role, I would have gone working in a Goldman Sachs or a Citibank or a HSBC in the fund investment, an investment banker type training. I'm blown away by seeing some of these people inside Alcyon. 26 and 29 years of age, and I mean, they are light years ahead of me. Light years.
So what would you like your kids to do then? Is it join the family business, go off and do their own thing, to get a job? What would you like them to do?
To not worry about work or being a winner or a loser until they're at least 30. Like, just go in, enjoy your life and have a ball. Like, they'll have to work, and obviously, but don't have any concerns about getting serious about anything until you're at least 30. Go and enjoy yourself. Yeah.
That's all right.
No, but like, in a good way though.
How do you think you balance that though? Because like, they're going to come into a very different situation. Obviously you came up in a very successful family business as well, but different time and different situation, whereas they're going to come up with you very modern, very switched on dad. Like, how do you kind of keep them balanced, I suppose, is the question.
Their mother, Niamh, is definitely the balanced person. I'm a disaster. Like, I can't say no. May, my daughter, says she doesn't even finish the word can, and I'm like, yes.
I'm the same. My wife just shakes her head at me. She goes, I thought you'd be the strict one. You're the soft one.
Did you just buy him an iPhone 17? I'm like, yeah, like you said, to get him a phone. I was like,
I meant a brick phone.
So the 1 terabyte one was a bad idea.
Look, but how do you manage that though? How do you think about that? Because you're going to have that kind of decision soon. Like,
I think up to the age of them starting work, it's not me. It's Niamh, unfortunately.
Okay.
I can't. But once they come to work, they can do whatever they want. It's just, I think that world of private equity and the work ethic, the culture in a good one, the culture has to be right. Mm. The learnings are just through the roof. And once you've got that kind of all-round legal, financial, commercial, yeah, the world's your oyster. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, it could be incredible training. So then bring me back, because we flash forward quite a bit, bring me back to your kind of 12 months in, you're learning, you're getting some new business into the new company. What happened? Like, because obviously we're sitting here, spoiler alert, I know where you are now, but like, what happened?
We just kept doing the same things, the right things. And we started getting trust on a few projects in the US. We started to get a lot of wins under our belts in Australia. And as you get bigger, it was the foundation of the company. I was adamant we were going to get the best people no matter what that we could get. Didn't matter where they came from. It was all about setting a culture and an environment for everybody to achieve the best they could achieve. I'm not going interfering with somebody. I was there to help them. Our offices, I would every day tell them, you're an overhead to the business. You're a cost to the business. The only people in our business that are important and make us and keep me in a job and you in a job are those people out in those sites. Don't ever look down on them. They are the core of what we do. So we set up a transmission business where we brought huge transmission jobs in Australia. We pretty much have 120 Irish and UK and Canadian guys doing 9 weeks on, 3 weeks off to Australia. So we'd meet them at the airport. We'd take them to the hotel. We'd get them their driving license. We'd get them their bank accounts. We upskill them to get all of the qualifications to be able to work in Australia. But that took a year and a half to get through the RPL process. But we took them through their white card and all of that kind of stuff. And we built trust. Like, it's hard. There's a few of them from Kerry. There's 20 or 30 of them from Kerry. And you can't catch a cute Kerry whore, like, you know. But we've built trust with them over.
So they fly out. They fly for out. 9 weeks. 9 weeks. Work like hell.
Free accommodation. Off you go for 3 weeks. Food, and then they fly back to Ireland for 3 weeks.
And then back out.
Yeah.
That's unreal.
And then lots of them have moved into relocating their families to Australia.
Mm.
And we go above and beyond there. I'd like to hope we're still doing it, but it's, we'd go above and beyond. We'd help get their families out, get them their visas. And then they do 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And then some of them have even moved their families to where the project is, and they work 56 hours a week.
Like what you did back in the day.
Yeah.
So it's all gone full circle.
Yeah. So, and we'd have massive trust built up with them. And that's kind of...
How do you build trust?
I think following through on what you say you're going to do and never lie. And we've never lied. We've always been very moral compass true north. There's been a bit of a communication breakdown in the language between Cork and Kerry, for sure, at times. but no, I think, you know, if you can create an environment for people to put their hand up and say, I've made a mistake, or I can't do it, but I can do those three parts, but I know who can do those two parts. Now you've got a very competent person in a perfect environment. And that's what we have. Like, it's an amazing place to be around at the moment. It's unbelievable.
No ego and self-awareness is a killer combo.
Phil Green, like, I've never met anybody with, he's no ego whatsoever. He actually thinks everybody in the room is better than him. But they ran a thing two weeks ago in Alcyon where they, an AI versus Phil Green, who calculate the IRR off these balance sheets. And as long as the accuracy didn't need to be anything better than 0.5%, so if it was 0.5 or higher accuracy, Phil won.
No way.
0.4 and below, the AI won. And he was telling me the story, and he goes, yeah, but there was only to 0.5. I'm like, what is IRR?
Yeah, I did pass maths, so we're gonna skip along nicely.
I did the same.
Look at us now. So then what was, obviously you built momentum in this company. Like, so how, what happened? Like, bring us up to speed. So that was only 2022, right?
2022 we started.
So we're sitting here in mid-2025. Like, that's not long.
Yeah, we...
So bring you up to speed and where we are.
Like, we're 800 people.
From 28.
From 28, yeah. And definitely going to be double that by February next year, if not quadruple that. Only if the growth can be controlled. So we've a lot of senior people coming in now, kind of making sure now anybody that I hire is someone that I know and trust, or known by someone that I know and trust.
So do you mean people around you?
So we've new leadership coming into the company now. It's been coming in, and it's coming in over the next while. So I've got six real top tier senior people joining in the next, two have joined already and four are coming in the next 2 weeks. And these guys, it takes, they're, when you actually eventually get their trust to join you, it's not a 4 week notice period with these guys. It's always three months or 6 months. So I've been working on this from 12 months ago, and now only just in time they're coming. So it's a significant time in our company.
People say this all the time, the people. But what is it for you that makes a great person to join your company?
Okay, so IQ would be huge.
IQ,
they must be smart. I don't need a degree, I need smart.
What's the difference?
I think lots of people can have a degree and not be smart, not have common sense. Maybe it's common sense. IQ and common sense, I'd say. Mm. Integrity, honesty. If they don't have honesty, a really good person that lies to you is worth nothing because you don't know what's real and what's not. Hardworking would be massive. They must have that drive in them. And I think a sense of humor, because if they can't laugh about it, like, they just go crazy. Because it is crazy. Some of the stuff that goes on is mental. Yeah, so.
So you're at 800 people now.
And we are definitely double the size. Like with the orders we have, we're definitely double the size by February. Definitely. And we could be north of 3,000 by next May or June, but we need to control it. And it's now with the new leadership coming in and with our new kind of, this infinite game that Simon Sinek's guys, talk, it's touched everybody in the company. And it's now we're going to make sure we do it right. The relationships we have with our clients is so straight up and down. We like our values of we care and protect our people, we act with integrity, and we follow through. The caring, protecting our people are our clients, they're our employees, they're our subcontractors. Telling them the truth and being integrity driven is huge. And we follow through is if we say we're going to have 50 people on site next week and they're the best 50 guys they can get, if we don't, if we can't get them there and we find out 3 days before, we act with integrity, we tell them the truth. It's just this revolving circle of perfect values. And in that Simon Sinek's talk about the finite game and the infinite game, it's been quite an emotional couple of weeks for us. And we've got a conference in Mount Juliet in mid-September. And
that's just because you can play golf there. That's the entire reason it's down there.
Yeah.
It's an incredible spot. It's a beautiful hotel.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Phenomenal. It's amazing.
We went there for my birthday 2 years ago, I think. Oh my God. It's one of the most beautiful places I've been in Ireland.
Yeah, and the people down there are unbelievable as well.
The hospitality.
It's unreal.
Because you go to some nice hotels and it's quite stuffy. I don't like that.
No.
Whereas you go down there and you're like, it's beautiful. And there is welcoming.
Oh yeah.
We went in and went into reception. Our daughter was only about a year and a bit at the time. And straight off, they're like, hold on. They go in and they get the little Mount Juliet puppy and they bring her out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is for her. This is Juliet the puppy. And you're like, oh, wow.
Unbelievable. That's
just little touches. Just warm hospitality. It's a great spot. So what's the conference then?
So the conference, it's when it was we did one in the Blue Mountains in March 2024. And then we were going to have one every year. But in January 25, I would have said, right, we're having it in September. It was perfect timing. I knew where I was with the leadership team. I knew where the work was. You're still scared of organizing something 6 months out and you might have no company. Like the fear of failure was still very strong.
Still.
Oh, unbelievable. Unreal. So.
Do you feel it now?
Oh, yeah. I do, but it's becoming less because there's stuff happening now and there's work being won that I'm not part of. We're up to that point in time, it wouldn't have. So I would have been across everything.
What do you want this time around?
I want to build an infinite company, really. I want to build a team that will last for a long time and generations to come. Something we built our values and our mission. And again, like I had to learn what was the vision, what was the mission, what were our values. But it's just to create something that we're proud of. That was what we all wanted as founders. We wanted to create winning partnerships with clients that disrupted the industry. There was no becoming the world's number one in HV testing. You know, it was never like that. It was just about winning partnerships, trusting relationships that disrupt. And that's where it was all came from. And when you look at, and I see Simon's infinite game, it's just like, wow, we've been actually doing this all along. Without knowing it perfectly. Like I've got a call with him on Monday. I'm on the third call. He's a big sum of money to get him for a day. Like a huge sum of money. Like
Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
You like, a call with him?
No, I'm on the third last gate and I've pitched two people so far and I've got now Todd, the last guy before Simon, and I want a donation of his time. Whether that's a 15-minute video or a one-hour video or in person.
To work with you.
On our summit. Because I believe amazing. If he actually sees what we're doing and what we have, if it's a theory, I don't understand if it's a theory out of him yet or if it's a suggestion, but we've got everything that he's talking about in its absolute bubbliness. The only thing that we don't have is, and we do, but it's only dawned in the last 48 hours that we do, is the just cause. Because my just cause can't be the company's just cause. and the just cause of the company is the values. I only realized it, I think it was last night maybe, or the night before. So yeah, I think he'll be blown away when he sees what we have. And my personal journey, I think if once he hears it, I hope he will do a donation of time up to a pint, because I've my private equity fund definitely won't sign off that many zeros.
It's just $250,000 payment. That's cool though. But I like the way you're thinking. You're thinking big. Like you're thinking, going, oh, why can't I get Simon Sinek? Like, I think that's what we need more of in Ireland, is this thing going, oh yeah, I like the talk, but now I'm going to go to the main guy.
But that was the intent the whole way along, was if he's talking the truth about what he's talking about and he believes in it that much and he wants to change the world, well, he's got the perfect audience here to change 800 people's view on everything. And 800 people, if they teach 10 people each, he's spreading his word a lot deeper. I can't believe I've never heard of him.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. Start With Why was the big one. That was his big kind of breakout. And then The Infinite Game. I think The Infinite Game is a better theory.
Oh.
I think it's more relevant to where we are now in the world. I think it's just, he's hit the right note. How do you balance everything? Mm-hmm. That answers it.
I don't know. I think I'm getting better. I've definitely got awareness of it now anyway. Awareness is there, I suppose. But patience and balance are not something that comes very naturally.
You seem like a man in a hurry.
Do you know what? It's trying to get out what's in my head. I find it very hard to communicate. Some of the head would be spinning. To get it out is quite difficult. But I am... Yeah, I've surrounded myself with unbelievable people now, and they get me. Mm. And they know I'll be coming back 2 minutes later laughing, and they get it. It's just, it won't be clear to them for a while. We're in the middle of an acquisition here in Ireland at the moment. And 6 months ago when I went to the board with it, they were like, what are you doing? And I pretty much said, well, if you're not supporting this, I'm leaving C2O Group and I'm going to do this on my own. And they were like, okay, come back, mate. We'll back you up. I'd throw my ties out of the prem. But now they can see it. You know, they're like, do you know what I mean? At the time, I just didn't have time to sit down for a day and explain it to them.
Right, you couldn't. So how do you do that now? Like, because this is definitely a big problem most, if not all, entrepreneurs have, is that urgency and that vision, and you want to do it right now.
Yeah.
I'm very guilty of this myself. I'll make a decision and I'll do it that day and I'll book the venue. But like, trying to explain that then, or did I not tell you about that? Like, the amount of times I've said that is, did I not tell you what we're doing, the Sugar Club November 30th? Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're doing, you know.
Yeah.
How do you now get that across?
Phil's helped me with that. Like, the Alcyon structure has helped me with that. That's been, you know, the processes, the procedures, the management of funds. When you actually go through the steps of following the system,
right,
and you always have the back door to get something done in a quick hurry, which I tend to use too many times, just I'm being made aware of it. You've now used it 5 of the last 6 times. Right. Well done for using the system that one. You know,
we're training you slowly.
Yeah. It's just awareness, really, you know, and they've helped me with that hugely. It's I know Alcyon have fallen in love with C2O Group as much as I have. You know, they're a private equity fund. They want to make money. They want to put money into a company, make it better and exit. But they're after falling head over heels over this. And they see the upside. They see the growth. They see the potential. And very few companies actually do what they say they're going to do. And we've probably done triple what we've always said.
So how do you look after yourself? You look like you're in good shape. You seem fairly clued in. Like, how do you look after? We talk about the body, the brain and the business on the podcast, trying to see how do founders manage all three. So how do you look after yourself?
Honestly, 12 months ago, I would have been looking at people that were obesely overweight, especially in Texas. And I'm like, how in God's name could you get to that size? Like, I could not be any worse on my body. And like, I'm 110 kilos. How can you get to that size? Because I could not be any more abusive to my body with drinking and food and like terrible. I was so fit going into the company C2O. And now, to be honest, I just go for a walk in the morning, or I do something. I go for a walk. And when I'm on a call, I'll just go for a walk outside when I'm on the phone. Besides walking around the office or sitting down, I just go for a walk. I don't do any running. I'm going to try and do a bit of gym gear, but yeah. I don't
know. You look like in good shape anyway, so you're doing something right.
Walking.
You heard it here first. Walking. And then in terms of your own mental side of things, you referenced it earlier, you had a very tough time after the first sale. So what's different this time around? How do you mind that balance?
Alcyon and Phil Green, that whole structure. Okay. So they've done it
people?
Before. People, yeah.
People, the right people this time?
Right people, yeah. And then just someone that's done it before, like Phil's ran companies in three different continents at the same time. So he gets it that you're going to lose a lot of sleep. You're going to have to mind your body. He gets the what you, it's just when you do the wrong thing because you're so tired and you snap at somebody, it's just, mate, that's normal. Like you've had 6 hours of sleep in 3 days, mate, you're all right. So that kind of just that comfort of knowing you're not a Looney Tune has made a huge difference this time for sure.
Okay. Before we get to our like, and I'll, quick fire round. What's the next? You kind of alluded to earlier, like you're going to try double and maybe treble. Like, what's the kind of in first and down here in 12 months again? Like, what would you love to have happened
in the next 12 months?
Next 12 to 24 months. What would you love to
that
to
we're have we're better at following our values in 12 months' time than we are now? That would be huge. We're better at doing what we do in 12 months' time than we are now. And I think if we could diversify, we're going to try and get into the European market now pretty heavy. Especially Ireland and the UK, just that we enter that better than we ever have with any other region. So, yeah.
Okay. Quick fire round. Huh. What book has had the most impact on you?
I've never read a book.
No way.
I swear to God, no. Bob Rutella was given to me by my aunt when I was playing golf. She was trying to get me to become Zen. And she's told me more, but I got the three P's from it: practice, patience, and perseverance. I've never read a book.
I love that honesty. Thank you. You didn't just bullshit and go, oh, I really love whatever. Fair play.
I don't think I'd remember the names of the three books that I'd have to bluff you on. I think that's why I backed out of it.
How do you consume information? Because you clearly take in a huge amount.
People, conversations, like that podcast now. I very rarely even finished one of those, but people and talking to them. And learning it myself by doing.
I think that's knowing what you're good at is the key thing. Yeah. Not forcing yourself to work on your weaknesses. I was thinking about this today, actually. I think too often we just drive ourselves to try work on the weaknesses. Oh, I must become a reader. I must become that. If that's not how you learn and that's not how you get information,
yeah,
there's quicker ways to do it. What's your superpower?
Perseverance. I remember when I was playing golf, trying to be a professional golfer. Back when I was not a good amateur, I met a guy staying in Carton House in a B&B, and he was a professional golfer on the European Tour playing the Irish Open. And I asked him at the breakfast table, I said, how the bloody hell do I become a pro golfer? And he said, it's simple. Practice more than me, and eventually you'll get better than me. But he said, if you're going to find it very hard to be better than me, I practice for 10 hours a day. So I literally have that superpower in work. I will work nonstop. That's my only superpower, is my work ethic, my engine, I suppose.
It kind of alludes to the same thing. What's a daily habit is the key to your success?
A daily habit?
What daily habit? What do you do every day you think is the key to your success? You probably alluded to it there.
Okay, just being open. Like, people will laugh now when they hear this, but in business sense, I am the most self-aware, the most honest person on the planet, and I am very open about my flaws and learning from them. Continuous improvement is definitely something that's, I would every day sit back and kind of go, that doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel right. Oh, you were a donkey there today. What'd you do that for? That would be a
good self-awareness.
Yeah, in business, yeah.
So what entrepreneur or founder do you think everyone should be looking at in 2025 to learn from?
Entrepreneur. I just in my head there. In Ireland, I think the likes of Kieran Walsh, the likes of Cash, just anybody that's, it doesn't matter if you've one person in your business or 1,000, it's the same stresses. It's probably harder with one than it is with 1,000 because you don't have a finance team with one, you don't have a commercial team. There are some special brains in Ireland, like the likes of Kieran Murphy, now from GE Healthcare. Like, he was the CEO of that company. I think it was making $2 billion a year that time when he was CEO. You've got the likes of Barry English with Wintrap. You've got Donald Slattery with Avalon. Eugene Murta, you've got my father, you've got unbelievable entrepreneurs around Kieran's dad, Dennis, like, his story's probably way better than Kieran's. So don't mind Kieran, actually. Get Dennis in here.
There you go, Kieran. You're off the list. Your dad's in.
Get his dad in. Like, it's an unbelievable story. If he tells you the truth, the story I've heard, I've never tested it with him, actually, and I should, but the story I heard was that he was a storeman made redundant from a company, and instead of taking the money, he took the stock. And that's how he started his engineering supplies business. So if that's true, it's pretty impressive.
Great start.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can invest it in one company or one person. Who are you investing in?
I'd invest it in our company, C2O Group. That's a wussy answer.
Give me a proper answer.
Anybody that's being mentored in C2O Group right now to be a leader in, because we are going to start diversifying and people are going to start drifting into private equity world. Any of those people, I would, yeah, because I know they're going to be after taught it the right way. Or if Barry English was doing something, I'd definitely...
You
want to love me.
If you were starting from zero again in 2025, what would you build?
I'd definitely get in something with AI anyway. Drone inspections with AI. Right. I think that whole world. I think cosmetics, like the Botox and the hair removal and all that kind of stuff.
Flying.
Barber shops that are, I was getting my hair cut in Cork last week. I was investing money in your man's barber shop rollout across Ireland. What else?
See that addictive nature of like investing in different things.
And you know what? Anywhere that I'd go that I'd find an unhappy workforce that's making money, I would go in. It doesn't matter what it's in. It's just, I was in a hotel recently, meant to be a 5-star off the charts hotel. I could not understand, even if you tried to put the pawns and the chess pieces on the table, any more wrong. Like the king was being positioned...
Near Dublin outside?
No.
Still there?
No.
Okay.
You just couldn't put a group of people in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing anymore. Like it was just dreadful. But I'd definitely get in I'd set up a hotel right alongside them because you'd know.
Buy it out.
Easy.
What do you believe that other people would find weird or strongly disagree with you on?
I don't have an office. I walk around. I literally talk to the people every day that are doing the work. And I rang someone 15 minutes before I came in to remember those three questions. What were they? And I don't have an office. I walk every day. I talk to the people. I throw my backpack in any office I go to. I throw my backpack. They joke around and they put my name outside the boardroom. That's my office, the boardroom.
Service free.
Yeah, I don't have an office.
I like that.
Yeah.
What has been your best investment?
Probably the help that I got after the last exit. When I was really down and out, investing in the people that helped me get my head back, yeah, was the best investment I ever made, by far.
Do you mean advisors or do you mean personal help or what?
Yeah, personal help, yeah. Was probably the best thing that I've ever done.
What's been your worst investment?
There's been a lot. In myself after when the money landed in my account, investing in the fund, the celebrations was probably the worst investment. Anything I've done where I haven't been involved in has been a bad investment. Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of scam artists out there. Like there's a lot of cheating going on out there, and I'd be a believable person to an entrepreneur because I'd have a soft spot for it.
Mm.
So when you hear the struggle, it's like, oh man, I'll give you money.
Is it cheating or just incompetence?
Cheating would be a lot of it. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Cheating. And then again, you can't get a cat. You can't ask a cat. Like if I ask a cat to bark, I should know that the cat can't bark. So I'm wrong for asking the cat to bark. So I should have known.
But how do you know it's a cat in the first place if you can't
exactly.
see it?
Exactly. So don't invest money in it until you're sure it's a dog.
Fair.
Yeah.
I think that's quote of the year. What has been the best bit of advice you've gotten in the last year?
To make sure we don't... to not drink the Kool-Aid was probably... It's reminded to me. But drinking the Kool-Aid is just believing your own... Are you actually drinking and swallowing your own crap? Are you bullshitting to yourself? So are you swallowing the Kool-Aid? Yeah, if everything's going your way, make sure you're not on the wrong side of the road. So it's like continuously pull yourself up and make sure, whoa, you're getting carried away in the giddiness here now, and pulling yourself back and grounding yourself. Because when everything's going up, it can go like that very quickly. And we're on a project right now where there's been a fatality on another company's employee. And like that would just devastate us. Like I don't think any of us founders would survive something like that happening to one of our people. So yeah, just calm the chaps and make sure you do things properly and don't get carried away.
Where can people learn more about C2O Group and yourself?
C2OGroup.com, we're on website, but LinkedIn is, we've started doing our media campaign and it's really good. It's brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Paul, that was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.